Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. You can find our podcasts at www.educause.edu/podcasts or by searching for EDUCAUSE on iTunes.
I'm here talking about learning spaces with Carol Wedge, president of Shepley Bullfinch Richardson and Abbott, and Barbara Weaver from Customer Relations and Learning Technologies and the English Department at Clemson University. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
You're
very welcome. What are some of the ways the physical makeup of a space can affect the way students learn? And what are some of the traditional assumptions about learning spaces that you'd like to challenge?
Probably I think the most specific is if learning spaces are designed for one-way activity, if they're designed for a lecture format, it's very difficult to engage students. And sort of the old framework of fixed seats in a fixed environment all facing towards the front of the room doesn't foster the level of engagement or dialogue that many faculty are trying to introduce into their courses. So the spaces aren't able to adapt to the pedagogical changes. And as a result, they frustrate everyone. So they frustrate the student, they frustrate the faculty. So I think, you know, there was an era of trying to standardize every classroom so it was the same. That, in combination with the idea that you can convey or teach every component of the curriculum in 50 minutes, are two of the notions I'd like to change about the way we think about learning. And I think we think of lecture as learning, and lecture is just one very small part of the learning virtuous cycle.
I would add to that, just at Clemson, that we all recognize that the sage on the stage is not something that a lot of faculty want to do anymore, but we do have those spaces, then we need to be using those spaces. So we've introduced clickers and different ways of engaging students because that's the space we have in some locations, you know, for big introductory courses in chemistry or physics, for example. But we are working towards using other spaces in creative and innovative ways. So the math department, for example, has switched almost all of their classrooms to be a modified scale-up. They range from 48 or 54 seating capacity down to about 36. And it's a wonderful space that lots of people are after. And then most recently, we turned an abandoned swimming pool into a state-of-the-art experimental classroom. So sometimes you have to live with some old spaces that you wish you could, but you can't change them all at one time. So it is a matter of priorities and commitment and buy-in from different departments and colleges around campus and making that happen. But I think everybody's recognizing that it's something that needs to be done.
Jerry, one of the things design can do is introduce a couple of experimental spaces or lab spaces, as Barbara talks about. And if they're not scheduled by the registrar so that they're used every block of the week, you can start to use that as a diverse place that faculty could sign up to take their class a couple times during the term, so it starts to open up what's possible in the different environments. And I think that's one way other institutions, as well as Clemson, have found that they can create a little wiggle room in the system that can then let people test new ways of teaching, and then that can inform the incremental renovation of lecture hall spaces that we have that we've really inherited from different era.
You mentioned the experimental classroom and the abandoned swimming pool that you built, and you obviously have some ideas on designs for newer learning spaces. Can you give me some ideas on what some of the forward-thinking design concepts are right now for collaborative learning?
Well, the things that we're thinking about, and none of us have design backgrounds, but we started with a pedagogy first. You know, what is it we want to do? What is it we want our students to do? How do we want to interact with our students? And we had multidisciplinary representatives there from all over campus. We had staff there. We had students there. And we were able to come up with this long list of things that we wanted to be able to do and how we wanted to use that space. And then we started saying, oh, well, okay, let's see. We could do that with this, and we could try that. And we ended up with a space that is very sought after. We have a waiting list now. People are wanting to have more of these rooms on campus, and we're moving in that direction.
When I think of the future and what's coming, I think it's designing those spaces that allow for many possibilities. And, you know, probably the nature of institutions has been to try and synthesize something down to a solution that was going to fit everyone. And then it was mutually you know, uncomfortable or ineffective for everyone. So I thought the framework of thinking about the class as a studio space that can be used for many different ways of teaching, and that usually means that space might be bundled with a much greater intensity of technology or a much greater array of furniture types or an ability to have breakout spaces that work with the classroom. So you actually might, for a course, be assigned, you know, a main teaching space and then a couple of breakout spaces so that you can think about the class as a studio. One of the most creative faculty I've worked with said, I'm not so focused on how I get to the outcome, but I know I need to get to the outcome. So it's almost like improvisation. You know, as I get to know the students, I can get more creative in how I can get this group of students to get to that outcome. And I think beginning to think of the learning process as that studio-based and a little bit more personalized and customized process also makes it more interesting for the faculty member who is teaching a class that they've taught many times before. So they're looking for ways to bring new freshness to it and to really light the spark within the students.
And I think, too, the number one principle we had going in was we wanted space that was flexible. We wanted to be able to create this room that had current technology and some things that we hadn't tried before, but we also wanted that flexibility so that we could plan for what's coming, especially in tight economic situations, but really all the time, at least at Clemson, we have to take advantage of what we have and be frugal. And so we wanted to prepare the room for the future. We've talked about, and we'll never be finished, you know, so this is a space, and when somebody says, how much is this costing, we can't really tell them because we'll never be finished. It's always going to be evolving into something else, whatever comes next. But we wanted to make sure we had enough power to accommodate what comes next. We wanted to have a grid in the ceiling that had Ethernet and power in it so that down the road, if somebody wanted to install motion detectors or thermometers or some other kind of data collection, that students in that class could collect live data and analyze it right there in class. Mm-hmm. So we were trying to think ahead like that of how people might want to use it and what might be coming down the road that we would be ready for, so that we didn't have to, we only had to find the money for the new technology. We didn't have to find the money to completely renovate the room over again.
It sounds like there's sort of two things going on here with learning spaces. There's the space itself, arrangement of furniture, shape of the room, etc., like literal space, and then sort of the accoutrements like projectors, Ethernet, utilities. Can you talk about sort of the relationship of those two things and how they are either complementary and how they might not be complementary?
Well, I think it starts with what Barbara described as that, you know, what are we trying to do in here? And the longer and more thorough the list of what you're trying to do in those kinds of spaces can be, the more you can start to anticipate when those things are going to be in conflict. You know, when the lighting in the room was designed for generic lighting and it doesn't have different scenes and it doesn't have any dimmable characteristics, so that pretty much any projection or a diversity of projection is going to be in conflict with that. I think that's a tricky thing to make successful in a room. But it's not hard. It's just it needs to be anticipated. And sometimes I think the left hand and the right hand don't always know what they're doing. So, you know, in a worst case scenario, there might be an institution where the facilities department's just going to go through and renovate all these rooms because they're on the upgrade schedule, and they're not necessarily going to have time to talk to the users to think about what are they going to do, or they're not talking to academic computing or the instructional technology support group to say this is what's coming, or engaging the faculty and say, how do you see yourself self-teaching even in the next 5 years? So I think it's aligning those. But back to what Barbara said, they've designed a space to change. And it's much different designing our perfect classroom as opposed to our classroom as a studio that's going to change and evolve every term. And then I think you can open the discourse a little bit more. And so, you know, if the lighting can be moved, if the technology can be moved, if the furniture can be moved, you open up a lot more possibilities. And I think you start to create the people that use those spaces as kind of part of the team of the problem solving of the environment. I'm not an educator. I work with a lot of them. So I've learned a lot from them. But I think it's also putting some of the pedagogy back in the faculty's mind, you know, and allowing them to think about, how should I be teaching this? How do I want to be teaching this course?
Mm-hmm. And that brings to my mind something that we're dealing with right now, just as an example. We started out with our instructor station in the center of the room in the what we call the sandbox classroom, but it's the experimental classroom that was created up from the swimming pool. Some faculty love having it in the center of the room, and some people hate it being in the center of the room. And we knew we would run into those kinds of issues, so we said starting out that everyone who teaches in there has to agree ahead of time that there will be times when something's being tried that you aren't going to like. But there will be other times when there's something that you get to try that everyone else, or maybe some other people, aren't enjoying very much. But we will accommodate those things that people want to try out. So we also made the commitment that we weren't going to try to build in so much flexibility that you would change it on the fly. You know, you weren't going to, 9 o'clock class would be this way and 10 o'clock class would be that way. We would agree to really try a particular configuration for a length of time, like 1 to 2 semesters, and maybe we would change the configuration during the summer when we had time to really think about it and talk about it and figure out, you know, what those changes needed to be and how we're going to assess them when we got in there and those kinds of issues. So we're trying to go about it smartly and figure out how we can be inclusive and accommodate everybody's desires to test different things.
Mm-hmm. While the goals of higher education are to help students learn and develop, is there a difference between learning focus and teaching focus? And if so, could you talk about those two design focuses?
And you hear a lot about student-centered now, and it used to be, if you look at the old style in classrooms, and you can talk about this probably better than I can, but the Sage on the Stage model is very teacher-focused. Mm-hmm. All the eyes are on the teacher. You know, the lights are on the teacher. You're in a big auditorium, maybe. You have very little workspace. And now everything has flipped where, like in my class, I don't lecture anymore. I might have like maybe a 5 to 10 minute thing where I'm explaining an assignment or something like, or doing some housekeeping kinds of things. But then we have student-centered activities, and the students are at round tables, they work in teams, they're mm-hmm. collaborating the whole rest of the class. That would be very, very difficult to do in a traditional classroom. And I've tried it, and not in a huge auditorium, but in a regular, you know, classroom setup. And it is very, very difficult to pull off successfully. You can't get to the students to mentor them or coach them. You can't find that teaching moment as easily because you can't even get to some of the students.
I also think there's good data. You know, the pedagogy is following a sort of broader reality that, you know, what's known as fact when a student enters college is no longer fact as they leave college. And so I think understanding that you're really teaching students to learn, you're not teaching them a specific array of content, and that the content is the device, and some of it's going to be relevant for a long time, and some of it's going to be relevant until there is new research or new science or new creativity. So I think that understanding has started to change the pedagogy so that it's more about process mm-hmm. than it is about exact outcome. And I think those are the environments where probably the most progressive clients we have are thinking of the whole campus as a learning environment. And every interaction, you know, the whole frame of discourse and exploration doesn't have, you know, 4 walls, and it doesn't have a continuum. It has many different experiences and components. And so I think the most creative teachers are thinking about the cycle of learning and all that's involved within that. I think the great opportunity is all of the buildings on campuses that haven't been renovated. You know, so when you think about in a more lean environment, you're probably not going to have the same level of donors that you've had. You're probably going to have to learn to develop an incremental capital improvement plan. But it lets you go back to your campus core and say, how do we reinvent this space? How do we reinvent this building? How do we start to bring it in alignment with our broader strategic goals? And I think that's an exciting opportunity, an exciting moment. There are some schools that are reintroducing faculty into the residence hall environment. They're reintroducing teaching and study spaces and breakout spaces into that environment so that the continuum of learning is much more broad. And then I think if you overlay all the social technologies and interactive technologies that most people would say our students are even more comfortable with, I think they're more comfortable entering, maybe not as comfortable going deeply into. The combination there, I think, is very exciting. So I think people are seeing even the level of thought and development students can get to in 4 years is really enhanced by thinking of it as learning instead of thinking of it as teaching.
That brings me to my last question, which is about the strategic goals of an institution, especially in light of the economic downturn we're facing. Can you guys talk a little bit about how learning spaces can be affected by budget and maybe some advice for universities looking at their learning spaces that don't really have much of a budget because of the economic downturn? Are there small things that can be done to improve classrooms?
I would say absolutely. Treating it as an opportunity to think, you know, with a different perspective. I mean, I think design's the challenge. If you can say, okay, how can we do this more frugally or more incrementally? That, I think, also gets you to what are our core values? What are the most important things to do, not what are all the bells and whistles we want to add to it? And then I think it comes, you know, from that strategic vision of where are we going? We know we're going to live through this tough economic time. All of these institutions intend to be here and intend to contribute to how we get through and create a new vitality economically. So I think it's a great opportunity to engage the students and faculty in thinking differently about the space, and that money hasn't always been the only solution. And I think it goes back to great ideas get supported in lean times and great. And, you know, there are always interesting opportunities in a downturn because people do think differently. And I think it can be an even more creative time because all of your preconceptions and assumptions are being challenged. So I think there's a kind of great vitality in that. There's a colleague of mine who said for a number of years, I'm worried we're overbuilding these campuses and that not every building needs a cafe and not every building needs 10 group study rooms. And if we did more of a holistic assessment, you know, which we're trying to do with our planning group, if we did a more holistic assessment of your campus in lean times, is that the time that you would actually teach more hours a day? Would you actually teach more robustly? Would you let courses say we'd rather do a 3-day studio and then 3 weeks online, and that gives us more creativity? So I think it gives you the opportunity to ask bolder questions that aren't as easy to ask in good times. And then I think to just do an assessment, a utilization assessment, some of the probably the dirty little secret in higher ed is these very expensive campuses are not very highly utilized. And that if you change your preconception about when people teach and when people are in class and thought differently about that, I think you could get more out of the engine than we do today.
I want to thank you, Carol Wedge and Barbara Weaver, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.